Numbers chapter 26, we're going to be looking at the recipients of grace. You'll see in the text there that it's a long text, that if we were going to take the time to work through it all, we would read through chapter 26 and we'd read through all the different clans of the different tribes throughout the entire nation of Israel. I think we'll just read the beginning of that chapter and we'll kind of skip down toward the end. And then we'll read through chapter 27 just to orient ourselves where things are at today. Numbers chapter 26. After the plague, the Lord said to Moses and to Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel from 20 years old and upward by their fathers' houses, all in Israel who are able to go to war. And Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, take a census of the people from 20 years old and upward, as the Lord commanded Moses. The people of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt were Reuben, the firstborn, down to verse 12, the sons of Simeon, according to their clans. Verse 15, the sons of Gad. Verse 19, the sons of Judah. Verse 22, the clans of Judah were 76,500. Verse 23, the sons of Issachar. Verse 26, the sons of Zebulun. Verse 28, the sons of Joseph. Verse 29, the sons of Manasseh. Then verse 35, the sons of Ephraim. Verse 38, the sons of Benjamin. Verse 42, the sons of Dan. Verse 44, the sons of Asher. Verse 48, the sons of Naphtali. Verse 51, this was the list of the people of Israel, 601,730. You get that number stuck in your head. Back in the first chapter, it was 603,550. We're just under 2,000 short of what we were in the first census. Verse 52. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Among these, the land shall be divided for inheritance according to the number of names. To a large tribe, give a large inheritance. To a small tribe, give a small inheritance. Every tribe shall be given its inheritance in proportion to its list. But the land shall be divided by lot according to the names of the tribes of their fathers they shall inherit. Their inheritance shall be divided according to lot between the larger and the smaller. This was the list of the Levites according to their clans. It goes down through that. Verse 62, those listed were 23,000. Every male from a month old and upward, for they were not listed among the people of Israel because there was no inheritance given to them among the people of Israel. Verse 63, these were those listed by Moses and Eleazar, the priest, who listed the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these there was not one of those listed by Moses and Aaron, the priest, who had listed the people of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. The Lord had said to them, they shall die in the wilderness. Not one of them was left except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Chapter 27, verse 1. Then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Maker, son of Manasseh, from the clans of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. The names of his daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the chiefs of all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he died for his own sin. And he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers. Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, the daughters of Zelophehad are right. You should give them possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers and transfer the inheritance of their father to them. You shall speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. And it shall be for the people of Israel a statute and a rule, as the Lord commanded Moses. The Lord said to Moses, go up into this mountain of Abiram, and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. And when you have seen it, you shall also be gathered to your people, as was your brother Aaron. Because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eye. These are the waters of Meribah, of Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin. Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep that have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, Take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Make him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. You shall invest him with some of your authority, that all the congregation of Israel may obey. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in. Both he and all the people of Israel with him, the whole congregation. And Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and made him stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole congregation, and he laid his hands on him and commissioned him as the Lord had directed through Moses. We've worked through several times where we're at in the book of Numbers, but we have to keep this in mind because it's really important. God brought his people out of Canaan, the place of bondage. He brought them out of Egypt, the place of bondage. He's bringing them to Canaan, the place of promise. Canaan is that one corner of creation. It's connecting three different continents, three separate continents. It's a crossroads globally. And God is going to station there at the crossroads of creation a people who are called by his name, a people who are crafted for his glory. And as people come and go and intersect at this three points, if you will, of creation, they're going to see a people whose land is governed by the Word of God, a people whose character is governed by the holiness of God, and they're going to understand there's something different about these people. But before others can recognize that, the people themselves must recognize it. Because God has called them out of Egypt, he brought them to Sinai. There he helped to shape their perspective of what holiness looks like. He helped to shape their perspective of what it means that they're his special treasure people, that they would serve as a kingdom of priests representing him to other nations, that through them all nations on earth might be blessed. They spend a year there. Then we have the book of Leviticus. And after Leviticus, and after the first 10 chapters in Numbers, we finally get to travel. We move right up to the edge of the promised land, where the spies go in and come back bringing a bad report. 10 were bad and 2 were good. And God promises that all 10 will die, and they do. But having listened to those 10 bad spies, the rest of the congregation are condemned not to enter the promised land. They're concerned. They're concerned that their own children would become food for the giants of Canaan. And God says, because you won't trust me, it's your children for whom you're concerned that they'll die. You will die in the wilderness while your children go in to inherit the promises that you refused to inherit. So they go back into the wilderness and they die. That's the whole purpose of the next several chapters. They're in the middle of the book. They die. And God marches them through the wilderness. He gives us some insight into their rebellions. Finally, that generation's dead. And it's time to move. God moves them north. And we've seen what that looks like as he's moved them up. Rather than fighting with Edom, because he wouldn't give them any inheritance in Edom, they go around Edom and come up by Moab. They go up and they fight the Ammonites up in that direction, both Og and King of Bashan. And then they move down, Og and Sihon, and then they come back down, and they're camped right here at right by Mount Nebo. And you've seen that it says here in our text in verse 1, they camped on the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, by Jericho. So this is where they're at. They're right at that place that they would enter. And so this is where the baton now is being passed. One generation is completely dead. We have Moses, who's still alive, but he's been promised he can't go in. We have Caleb and Joshua, who are faithful, and they're the old men in the group. And we have Eleazar, the high priest. He wasn't numbered among those who were numbered for war, so he wasn't condemned to die with the rest of them. He's about the same age as Joshua and Caleb. Those four, Moses, Eleazar, Joshua, and Caleb, those are the gray hairs in the community. And the baton is being passed from one generation to another. And as this generation receives the charge, as they receive the promises, as they receive the prospect of entering into a new land, of a new beginning, it's exciting. It's an exciting time. Because God calls them at this moment, just as he had their fathers the very moment before they go into the land. Numbers chapters 1 and 2. Number the people, the men of war, everybody 20 years old and above, so that they can go into battle, because the next thing on the agenda is battle. The next thing on the agenda is conquest. The next thing on the agenda is inheritance, blessing. And they're at that place again. So God brings this new generation, having known only the wilderness wanderings, and he's bringing them to a place where he's about to bring them over into that promised land. If we could boil things down to a very simple proposition this morning, it would be this. When facing the future, hold tight to what you know to be true. So as the baton is being passed from Moses, who's experienced God, who's talked with God face to face, as the baton is being passed, responsibility to another generation who must go in and do the fighting, as the baton is being passed of those who must pick up the promises and carry them with them into the promised land, the reminder of this text is that they've got to keep in front of them, in a way that a previous generation didn't, the things that are true and they know to be true. We're going to see, as we look here, that there's going to be three marks of a promising future. And these marks are going to set this generation apart from the generation that preceded it. The first is this. Every promising future inherits a checkered past. I think this is important for these people, but it's important for us to realize as well. Because none of us inherits a past that's perfect. We look to the future and we say, that's amazing, that's huge, that's big, that's phenomenal. But have you seen who I am? Have you seen what's connected to me? Have you seen what lies in my past? These people are the inheritors of the promises of God's people. But they're also the descendants of those who've died in the wilderness. These are the descendants of those who've rebelled time and time again, of those who've complained, of those who've had to die by plague, by fire, by earthquake, by rattlesnakes, or whatever kind of snakes, fiery serpents. They've died, they've died, they've died, they've died. These are the people that are called to a glorious future. This future then is informed by judgment. And we're given that reminder right in the very first verse. After the plague, the Lord said to Moses, after the what? The plague. A plague that they had to walk through. A plague that wasn't on their parents. A plague that was designed for them. Second generation of failures. Second generation of losers. This is a plague that they walked through, that they inherited by yoking up with the Baal of Peor, that they invoked on themselves because they themselves discounted their God. But as we work through this text, there's little vignettes, there's little passages that remind us about both judgment and of mercy. But as we go through, as we work through chapter 26, there's many different details that are given that are meant to remind them that their past isn't so great, that God isn't bringing them into this glorious future because of who they are as a wonderful, powerful, righteous, holy people. He's bringing them in because of His mercy, because they themselves have deserved judgment over and over and over and over again. In verse 1, it's the plague. In verse 5, we're given just a phrase. Reuben is what? He's the firstborn of Israel. Well, that just tells who he is. Well, yeah, but remembering who they are, remembering who Reuben is, Reuben the firstborn, who should inherit the blessing. Reuben the firstborn, who should have double the blessing of all the other brothers. Now, Reuben the firstborn, who slept with his father's concubine and disinherited the blessing. Reuben, who had to be passed over. Reuben, who inherited judgment. Reuben, who inherited a curse rather than a blessing from his father. Verses 9 and 10, we move just a little bit farther. We see that this Reuben clan is delineated down several generations until we come to verse 9. The sons of Eliab, Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram. Haven't we heard of them before? Oh yeah. These are the Dathan and Abiram, chosen from the congregation, who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah, when they contended against the Lord. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, together with Korah, when that company died. And the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a warning. Dathan and Abiram. Oh, and Korah. Remember, people of Israel, as you're getting ready to go into the future, remember, young person, as you're looking forward to the future, remember, newlywed couple, as you're looking forward to the future, that there's a checkered past from which you come, a checkered past to which you're connected. Others have failed before you, and you are capable of failure. You are. Understand what that failure looks like. Be afraid of it. But don't think that you yourself are better than those who've gone before you. We move on, verse 14. He references the Simeonites. The Simeonites, and then he gives their number in verse 14. And he says that their number has been diminished down to 22,200. Well, you wouldn't know that's a diminishment unless you looked back to chapter 1, verse 23, where you see that they were at 59,000 in the first generation. What would happen that 37,000 of that tribe would be dead, gone? And we look back just one chapter and we're reminded that Zimri, the one who came in with the Midianite woman, was a Simeonite. We're reminded that 24,000 are killed in that plague. We don't know if most of them were Simeonites or not. But we know that the Reubenites, the Simeonites, and Korah were all on that same side of the camp, apparently influencing one another, apparently inheriting the consequences of bad choices and rebellion against God. We go down just a little bit farther. We come to verse 19. The sons of Judah were and Onan. Wait a minute. I don't remember reading about them in Exodus or Leviticus or Numbers. This and Onan both died. And where did they die? In the land of Canaan. Does that sound striking? Well, not to us. We're reading Old Testament. We're talking about Israel. It doesn't sound striking to us. But put yourself in the shoes of these Israelites who are on their way to Canaan, to the Promised Land. Where did and Onan die? In the Promised Land. Was it promised to them when they died there? Yes. Why did they die there? Who killed them there? They died because of disobedience, and God's the one who killed them. In the Promised Land. And as God sets up this history for His people, saying, it's time. It's time for you to inherit the blessings. It's time for a good future for you. Grab hold of what you know to be true. Understand this, and don't you forget it. I am a God who's holy, and I will not be trifled with by anybody. And just because you're going to the promised land, the place of blessing, doesn't mean that you can live any way you want to. You must live in light of me. There's and there's Onan. We come down to verse 61 in this chapter. Come into a couple other characters as he lists out the Levites. Verse 61. And Nadab and Abihu died. Now, wait a minute. This is the tribe of the Levites. Who are Nadab and Abihu? They're priests, right? In fact, they're the firstborn of the priests, the high priest. These are high priests in training, is what they are. But they took God lightly. They didn't follow God's commands carefully. And God said, you can't treat me lightly, especially you. Those who are in positions of leadership, those who draw near, those who draw closest to me will be held most responsible to me to reflect my glory in entering into my presence. You must do what you do in light of what I've said, in light of who I am. And then we come down verse 64. And we see that there's another group of people that are judged. Verse 64, but among those numbered now here on the plains of Moab, there was not one of those listed by Moses and Aaron the priest who had listed the people of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. That whole generation is gone. That whole generation is dead. And as he sets up this list, as he sets up this census, he reminds them who they are. He reminds them that they have a checkered past. You don't come from spiritual heroes. You come from spiritual zeros. This is your history. This is your heritage. You are descendants of these people. Keep that in mind. I'm blessing you not because you are great, not because you are holy, not because you are righteous, not because you are wise, not because you are good. I'm blessing you because I'm choosing to bless you. I've made promises to the fathers before you. Those promises will be kept. But you yourself can keep yourself from those promises if you so choose, as others have before you. But not only is their past informed by judgment, their past is also informed by great grace. Great grace. And so as you work through this text once again, going back up toward the beginning, verse 2, God is speaking and he says, Moses and Eleazar, I want you to take a census. Take a census of, what's that next word? All. Take a census of all. Okay. We can say it like that because just in the past three chapters, we have Balak and Balaam. Balak who brings Balaam up on top of a mountain. And he says, Balaam, I want you to look out over this valley. I want you to see everything that you can see. You see it? What do you see, people? Let me tell you something. You're only seeing part of them. Let's go up to another corner. They go up to another corner, another mountain. And he says, okay, Balaam, look out. What do you see? People? Let me tell you something. It's only part of them. As God is speaking to Moses, he says, Moses, I want you to get a number of the people. I want you to count all of them, all of the congregation of the people of Israel. That is those who are participants of God's promises to the patriarchs. Now, I want you to understand something. There were three promises in particular. Number one, they will become a great people, innumerable, like the sands of the seashore, like the stars of the sky. He says, Moses, I want you to get a number of these people because I want you to understand that that part of the promise has been fulfilled. I want them to see my blessing. I want them to get a handle on the fact that their father Abraham who contrived to have a child in accord with my promise. I rejected that child and gave him one son at the age of 100 years old. And from that child of promise came two sons, one who was rejected and one who was chosen. From that chosen son came 12 sons. From those 12 sons came 70 whom I brought down into the land of Egypt. And over the course of four generations, 400 years, I multiplied them so that it was nearly 2 million people who came out, 600,000 men of war, 20 years and above. I want them to understand that I am a covenant-keeping, promise-keeping God. I want them to get that fixed in their minds by counting themselves, by enumerating the blessings one by one by one. I want them to see that I'm that kind of a God. I want them to see that they are of the age to go to war, because right now the seed promise is fulfilled. In just a moment, I'm going to fulfill the land promise. And then the third promise is set, that through them all nations on earth can be blessed. We see in verse 4 that these are the people of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt. Not only are they participants of God's promises, but they're participants of God's redemption. And he stresses there in verse 3. They've come out of Egypt, and they find themselves now in the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, right across from Jericho. And all of us who know our Bible are looking forward to Joshua chapter 6. When they march around Jericho 7 times, they blow the trumpets and the walls come tumbling down. We love to sing the song. We love to act it out in junior church. Jericho means something. Jericho means something for them. It means that there's a big roadblock to the promises of God standing in their way right now. And it's right across the river. God says, listen, I brought you out of Egypt, the superpower of the known world. You think one city is going to stand in my way? Look at where you're at. I've positioned you here. I've brought you here. It's been my cloud that's lifted up and gone before you. It's been my ark that's lifted up and gone before you. The ark being the very footstool of the throne of God. God says, I have chosen to come down and tabernacle among you and then lead you as your king into a land that I claim as my own. I have let it out to these tenants for some time who have defiled this land. I'm taking it away from them. I'm giving it to you. You're not taking their land. I'm giving my land to you, God says. And so they become participants not only of the promises of the land, but they become participants of the redemption of God as he reaches inside creation and takes back that which belongs to him in the first place. And he sets his people down where he's going to do something further through them for his purposes. Down in verse 11, we work through the Dathan and Abiram passage, which becomes a warning. But we see verse 11, but the sons of Korah what? Just say it out loud. Did not die. They did not die. Korah died. Dathan died. Abiram died. 250 men died, but the sons of Korah didn't die. In fact, if you go through Chronicles in particular, you'll see that the sons of Korah are commissioned for special service at the tabernacle. They become song leaders. They become worship leaders. There's a piety that's tied to the sons of Korah. The sons of Korah who would have died if they stayed with their father. The sons of Korah who would have died if they hadn't separated themselves from one who brought condemnation on himself. Can you imagine what that would be like? Sorry, Dad, I love you, but I love God more. And they chose God rather than Dad, and God blesses them. He says, understand, people, it may be your very father who sinned against me. It may be your very father who's swallowed up in my judgment. It may be your very parents that have refused my blessing. But you don't have to refuse my blessing. You might be as closely linked by blood as possible to condemnation, to damnation. But you yourself can be a recipient of blessing. Here's how I can prove it to you. The sons of Korah, whose dad was snuffed out, along with everything closest to him. But those who chose me have continued on. That's my grace. We come down to verses 20 and 21. He's speaking of Judah and all of his tribe and all of his clans. And you'll see that this listing of the people includes clans, not just tribes. In the earlier listing, there was just the tribe names. But what God is doing is he's setting up clans who will receive portions of an inheritance by clan name, not just by tribe. But each of the clans are going to have a special place within God's economy that's going to be handed out to them by lot, but the tribe will receive it based upon their size. We come down to verse 20 and 21, and we see that as Judah's line is being listed out, we come to the sons of Judah are Shelah, Perez, and Zerah in verse 20. Shelah was one of his original sons, but Perez and Zerah weren't one of his original sons. And then verse 21, the sons of Perez, and we go another step down, they are clans in and of themselves. Understand where they came from. It's Genesis chapter 38. It's not a very fun story. The story of Judah and Tamar, his daughter-in-law that he impregnates without knowing it, who he condemns to death until he finds out that he is the father of her children. They happen to be two. But God in his mercy takes man even in his sinfulness and he extends a blessing that's undeserved. Now don't get used to it. Don't bank on that. Don't just say, I can do what I want. I can sin against God. It's not going to matter. No. The whole point of that first list was it matters. It matters a lot. But here's the thing. When you think all hope is gone because of your performance, all hope isn't gone. Because God is still God. And God is still the kind of God that he is. He's a God who extends mercy. He's a God who brings calm in the middle of our chaos. A self-induced chaos. And all of these names that are listed in this record, in this roll call, is meant to remind these people of these two facts. You have a checkered past. So as this promise, as this future is being handed to you, understand this, that you're made of the same stuff as those who failed. But you have the same God as those who've succeeded. This is what belongs to you. So be careful. But be confident, because this is what belongs to you. We come down to verse 33. We see the tribe of Manasseh being listed out. This is one tribe that goes all the way down seven generations to the daughters of Zelophehad. Now these clans are being named by their fathers. So this clan, this father receives this land. This father receives this land. This father receives this land. Now we come to Manasseh. Great, 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 great grandson who has no sons. He just has daughters. Now what do we do? Well, we're going to find out in chapter 27. These daughters hold on to the promise, and God makes them the head of their own regions of land. We see the same thing down in verse 46. The daughter of Asher is Sarah. And we find out in 1 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 30 and verse 40, that she's uniquely named as a head of household. Why? We're not told that. We're just told that she is. But here's something that stands out as unique. God is gracing. God is giving. God is blessing. And he's doing it in some unique ways, some unconventional ways. But he's doing it to show that you can't pigeonhole this God. He's a God who loves to give. He's a God that you can bank on, that you can count on, that you can move forward with. Verse 54, we see that every tribe shall be given its inheritance. Verse 54, it's in proportion to its list. If there's a lot, it'll be big. If there's few, it'll be small. It'll be divided by lot. That is, you don't get to decide who gets what portion. I do. The land is mine. But I'm going to include everybody. But I'm the one who gives to each one according to lot, according to the names of their father's tribe. We see in verse 57 a special listing of the Levites. We come down to the end, we see that there's 23,000 of them. There's 1,000 more than there was before. That's important because earlier there wasn't enough Levites to make up for all of the people that they represented. The Levites were given no inheritance in the land. They were given an inheritance of nearness, of access to God. The Levites were actually given to God on behalf of the people. So rather than taking all the firstborns of everybody's tribe, God took the Levites as a whole to belong to himself. There's finally enough Levites to account for all of his people. That's a special means of grace. And they wouldn't have lost sight of that. These are just details that to us, we read through them, we read by them, and we blow past them. But for them, these are the details that prove that God is for them, not against them, as they're getting ready to move into the land. Then there's one last big beacon of hope as we come down to the very end of chapter 26. And we saw that at the very end that an entire generation was kept off this list because of their sin. But in verse 65, the Lord said to them, "They shall die in the wilderness." Not one of them was left. And then there's a big word in there. Except for Caleb and Joshua. And as this congregation moves forward, as this people gets past the baton, they said, are you sure? I mean, we do come from the lineage of those who've not done very well in the past. In fact, we ourselves have merited the judgment of God in just the last chapter. Are you sure this is a good idea? Are you sure we can do this? God says, look at Joshua. Look at Caleb. Let me explain for you what will happen. If you walk by faith in obedience to me, if you grab hold of my promises that you know to be true, I promise you, your blessing will be full and fruitful just like the lives of these men. So chapter 26, well, it doesn't seem to say a lot to us. It says a lot to God's people. He says, guard yourself because you are a part of a people who fail. But be sure of this, you serve a God who can help you succeed. Number two, another distinguishing mark of a promising future is this. Every promising future is built upon courageous faith. Chapter 27, we have the daughters of Zelophehad. Would you love saying that name, Zelophehad? When you see them listed out, these are the only women other than Sarah, the daughter of Asher, listed out in this entire lineage, in this entire census that's taken. We see that they're listed four different times. Three times in the book of Numbers and one time in the book of Joshua. But as these daughters come to Moses and to Eleazar the high priest, they have a request. And we see that as they take account of the fact that their father will receive no inheritance, which means they receive no inheritance, they frame their circumstance in light of God's grace. You see, their father had no sons. Whose fault is that? Is it their fault? Is it dad's fault? It's actually, if you want to say it, it's God's fault, right? I mean, God's the one who determines whether it's a boy or it's a girl. God, we're stuck with a situation not of our making. Now understand, our dad did have sins. And they explain that in chapter 27. Verse 2, they stood before Moses and Eleazar, the high priest. Verse 3, our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves willfully against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he did die for his own sin. He didn't go into the promised land. He was part of the murmurers. He was part of those who was condemned to die in the wilderness. And he did. But he didn't apostatize. Now, he might be one of those who was killed by the fiery serpents. He may have been one of those who died because he was craving quail. He may be one of those who died in the plague. We're not told where he died. He died for his own sin. But he didn't die because of a flagrant sin that subjected him to the removal of inheritance from God's people, is the idea, like Korah did. His name shouldn't be brought. Even Korah's name isn't wiped out. The sons of Korah are still given an inheritance. So he says, as Levites, their name continues. This man's name shouldn't be wiped out. He's a father who had no sons. He has a possession that you promised. And so, God, we're banking on your grace. You've promised a possession to your people. So it says down there at the end of verse 4, give to us a possession among our father's brothers. I like how Ian DeGede labels these daughters. He calls these, he says, these are the five feisty females of faith. The five feisty females of faith. Pretty good. But they framed their circumstances in light of God's grace. God, you brought us out. You numbered us with your people. Our dad can't go into the land, but you've promised us an inheritance. We just want to be included. Give us a part of your inheritance. Let us be a part of it. Write our names into it. Let us be taken care of. Let us be included is the idea. So whereas their father said no to God's promises, they said please to God's promises. And those promises that their dad threw away were the promises that over years in the wilderness that they learned to love and wouldn't do life without. These are five feisty females of faith. They come and they present their problem to God's man. They bring their problem to one who's been appointed by God to be the problem solver among God's people. They come to him publicly there in verse 2. And they stand before Moses. They stand before Eleazar the high priest. They stand before the chiefs of the people. They stand before the congregation of the people. They stand at the very heart of the community, at the tent of meeting. This is a public display, not primarily of rights. Please understand that. These women aren't claiming their rights. They're proclaiming their faith. God said, we want what God has promised. How do you think that affected everybody else in the camp? Stupid girls. Not at all. You know what? If these girls can bank on God's promises, don't you think we can? These girls are willing to stand up in their faith for God's promises. We want a part of it too. These promises that were so far in the future are right around the corner. They see it. And it was something that they wanted to grab hold of. It's something that others wanted to grab hold of as well. Then we see that they entrust the resolution to the goodness of God's character. Moses doesn't say yes, no. He just says, let me go talk to God about it. He goes off and prays. They say, that's all we want. You just talk to God. Whatever God says, we're good with. Oh, for such a simple spirit. Whatever God says, I'm good with. Is that true of your life? Whatever God says, as long as it aligns with what I say, I'm good with, right? That's how I approach. God, please do this because this is what I see as best. Moses just says, wait here, girls. Let me see what God says about this. Okay, whatever God says is going to be good. And God says they're right. And God gives a list of how things should be transferred when there is no male heir. And it goes to the daughters. If there's no daughters, it goes to the brothers. If there's no brothers, it goes to the clan. The next kindred. But the idea is God is pleased with their faith, and He rewards their faith. He includes them in that promise. Number three, a third distinguishing mark of a promising future is this. Every promising future requires strong and compassionate leadership. Moses is about to be removed from the scene. He removed himself. He's condemned with a generation that did not obey God. But God reminds him of that, but God's given him this time of termination, time of transition. Moses is leaving his mark on these people as he charts the course for them, as he gives them the vision, as he commits to them Deuteronomy, a book that frames all of their life in the land in light of the goodness of their God. Moses still has an important role. But in chapter 27, we see that God's getting him ready to be removed from the scene. He says, Moses, go up on this mountain and look over the land. I want you to see what I've been talking about. I want you to see why I've called it a land filled with milk and honey. I want you to see why this is a promised land, why I would give this land to my people, why I would write my name on this corner of the globe so that through this place all nations might see my glory. I want you to see it. I want you to see it as my friend with whom I've spoken face to face for the last 40 years. And as Moses receives this instruction, he's concerned. He's concerned about something because for 40 years, Moses has been tasked with a project not of his own choosing. God says, I want you to shepherd these people through the wilderness. And as he does that, as he takes up that mantle, as he takes up that instruction, as he follows God's purpose, leading the people of God through the wilderness, the people of God have rebelled against God. And twice God said, Moses, stand aside and let me strike them dead and I'll start over with you. And Moses twice stands before God and says, God, not on your life, not on your name, don't do this. Don't do this on behalf of your people. Don't do this on behalf of your own glory. You can't do this. And Moses intercedes for God as the person that God posted there to be an intercessor. And Moses shows us into the heart of God. God shows us into his heart as Moses pleads the character of God. Moses is constantly thinking about the people, constantly thinking about the people. Moses loves the people. Let's see if I can find this one quote because it's significant. You'll like this. Moses loves the people of God. They'd grumbled against him. They'd marginalized his importance. They'd rejected his leadership. They'd disobeyed his orders. But he still loved them. In Christian leadership, love matters most. And out of this love, Moses turns to God in verse 15 and he says, let the Lord, the God who gives all spirits, who ordains all spirits, let the God of all spirits appoint a man over the congregation so that they can have one to go out before them, come in. The idea is going out to battle and coming in victorious. So they can have a warrior, a leader, so they can have one who will shepherd them. And this picture of strength with compassion is mixed here and only one other place in Scripture. In Samuel chapter 5, when they're looking for a king to be a shepherd, that God will ultimately call David, and not David, but the son of David, to be the good shepherd and the divine warrior of his people. But as this story, these chapters conclude, we see that every promising future requires leadership that's both strong and tender, strong and compassionate. And we see that it requires a leader who's appointed by God. Moses says, God, you have to show us who you want. But it has to be one of your choosing. It has to be one, God says, that the people will acknowledge. So Moses, I want you to go down and I want you to commission him so that everybody sees the authority that I've given to you, I've passed on to him. And he says, he's not going to function, Moses, like you have. He's not going to function with me face to face. I'm going to give him revelation. He's going to have to submit to my word. He's going to have to also bank on others in the job that's his to do. Just like you and Aaron and Miriam were a team, this one has to work with others on behalf of others. Young people, as you're looking to the future, I wonder, do you ever look at your life and say, you know what? I don't know if God can use me. I don't come from a very glorious past. I'm me. And I'm connected to all this. Yeah. That's exactly the kind of person God can use. Well, then you'd say, you know what? Why would he include me? You have to be one who's willing to grab hold of God's promises and say, he included me. He included me because he's included me. Whosoever will, if any man desires, if any man trusts, if any man believes, if anyone would hold these things to be true, you know what, I can do that. I don't have to be a hero, but I have to believe God is my hero. I have to make him my, and I want to do that, like the daughters of Zelophehad did. Then you look at yourself and you say, you know what? Who's going to lead? Look around this room right now, just real quickly. We've got Jim, how old are you? 40. Steve, how old are you? Dan, how old are you? 52. Bob, how old are you? 84. Mike, how old are you? John, how old are you? How old are you? 54. We go around this room. You know what? Chris, 36? 36. One day, these guys are gone. Who's the next leaders in this room? Daniel, how old are you? Mark, how old are you? 30. You're just barely at that. You're at, just out of the baby stage there. Okay. Matthew, how old are you? 14. Michaela, how old are you? 16. Hannah, how old are you? 12. Okay. Amelia, how old are you? 16, just old enough to drive and be dangerous. 15. 16. 16. Right. Young people, you know what? You can't bank on somebody else doing the job. God wants to use you. God can use you. Are you willing to be used? Here's one thing. You're facing the future. When facing the future, hold on to what you know to be true. You've got what you need to succeed. You know that left to yourself, you're a failure, but you know that you're not left to yourself. And understand this, that God is too good to let you go. A baton is being passed. It doesn't really matter your age. A baton has been passed to you. You've got the next leg of the journey. Turn, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. The baton has been passed, and it's been passed to you. Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of testimony, all these witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings to us so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. Grab hold of those promises, because those promises, my friend, are for you.